Do you really think you can meet the Russian delegation looking like that?
No.
I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Thank you.
Did you just look at me? Did you? Look at me! Look at me! How dare you! Close your eyes!
This is Snails and Oysters. Hello, and welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual movie podcast. I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
How are you doing, Allie?
Doing good, just trying to survive the heat wave of 2022.
Yep.
Melting.
Deeply relatable.
Yeah. It's just been a heat dome, although currently there's a very dramatic thunderstorm happening.
Like, scary dramatic or just baroque dramatic?
Impressive. Okay. Dramatic. I'm not frightened. I'm, you know, my attention has been gotten.
You're like, okay, sky, you've got my
yeah
attention.
I'm like looking up from my phone like, okay, weather. Not much going on in my life besides weather.
That's it. That is something I seriously miss living in LA, is just weather of any kind apart from like sunny days. Like, I think it's rained 4 times in the 2 years since I've lived here, which is partly a drought thing, but also is just always pleasant. And as, you know, many a film can tell you, things being constantly pleasant is actually kind of crazy making.
You can probably tell not much is going on in our lives because we're talking about, we're just like, weather.
We are literally talking about the weather.
Weather. Anything else up with you?
Not really. I did. Listeners who listened to our Spartacus episode will remember that I have a deep and abiding affection for Charles Laughton, the actor who in that film played Gracchus and had various famous parts throughout a long and storied stage and screen career, and was a real life bisexual. And this week I watched the movie Hobson's Choice for the first time, which stars Laughton and was directed by David Lean. And then I watched it for the second and third time this week as well.
So we're going through a phase.
3 times this week I have taken an edible and watched Hobson's Choice.
Wow.
I don't understand the hold that this movie has on me, but it is so good. It's crazy.
Nice.
I don't think I've had an experience like this since I, like, first saw In the Mood for Love and had to watch it 6 times for a paper I was writing about it. Like, and even then, the first 2 rewatches weren't by choice. But then by the end, I was like, okay, yeah, this is a really good movie. This one, it was just immediately, I was like, I'm going to watch this again.
That's awesome.
On Friday. Yeah, it's really good. I highly recommend it to everyone. And if you want to hear my thoughts on each subsequent rewatch, you can head over to patreon.com/snailsandoysters and sign up for $5 a month to be a Patreon patron, and you'll get my film diary. I don't know what that voice was.
And you'll get no film diaries from me. But you will get bonus episodes.
You were talking about doing that. You were talking about doing a film diary, weren't you? At one point, you floated the idea.
Yeah, it might say floating. Well, we'll see.
It'll just be a floater. Oh, something I did watch this week that's relevant is I finally watched the pilot for The Great, written by Tony McNamara, also the writer of this week's episode, The Favorite. Well, co-writer.
Yes.
Dang, how did I not think of that sooner? That is the perfect segue into this episode.
How was it?
Oh, it's great. It's fantastic. I can't believe it took me this long to watch it. And I kept saying, I'm going to watch it. And then finally my partner and I watched it together. and we were watching it in their bed, and we started to fool around a little bit. And then I was like, listen, this is the closest I've come to watching The Great. If we don't watch it tonight, I don't know if I ever will. So we like separated and put on the show.
That's so funny.
And frankly, it was worth it. You know, I'm not going to say that the writing was better than Sex, but it was certainly worth delaying Sex for.
Damn. High praise. High praise.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, just to see Nicholas Holt play pretty much the same character, but more, definitely worthwhile.
Nice. Well, that's great. I should definitely give it a watch as well, because as listeners will hear, The Favorite is definitely one of my favorites, I might say.
I'm pretty sure we made that joke when we
I'm sure everyone who's ever talked about this movie.
Yeah. I think I said something about it being the critic's favorite.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's something for you to look forward to now.
The Favorite is a 2018 black comedy directed by Yorgos Lanthimos of The Lobster and many other films.
Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah. Dogtooth.
All of those movies that win big critical acclaim and you haven't seen.
Yeah, he pretty much only directs bangers. It's kind of nuts.
Yeah, it's wild.
This is another banger. It is about Queen Anne, who reigned from 1702 until 1714. And this is about the love triangle between the queen, her lady, her first lady. Yeah, obviously that's not what it's called.
Her advisor.
Her advisor.
Her confidant.
Her confidant.
Lady Sarah,
yeah. And then her confidant's confidant, her confidant's cousin, Abigail.
Abigail comes to the queen's court after her father has lost the family status and all of their money through gambling and drunkenness, and basically begs her cousin for a job at any position. She literally shows up covered in shit. And Sarah, out of pity, gives her a job in the kitchen, and from there, through sort of gumption and well-placed favors, Abigail works her way up to being Sarah's lady's maid.
But then Abigail goes even further, would you agree, yes, than being Sarah's lady's maid, and insinuates herself into the graces of the queen. This happens because Sarah is in the film, and also like this is relatively true to history, kind of the queen behind the queen.
Right.
And so she's busy running the country and kind of feels annoyed and burdened by having to spend so much time with the queen. So she thinks, you know, who can like kind of babysit the queen? My lady's maid, Abigail. But what she doesn't realize is that Abigail's very crafty.
Yep. And from there, it's sort of a game of heightening stakes as Abigail and Sarah compete to be the queen's
the favorite.
Yeah. And what starts as like various gossip items or spreading rumors escalates to poisonings and whippings and, you know, threats of banishment.
That secret ultimately, marriages.
Yeah. It ultimately culminates in Abigail married to a lord, regaining her noble status and convincing the queen to exile Sarah from court.
Which is quite a fall from grace for Sarah, because the film starts off with the queen gifting Sarah an entire palace.
Yeah.
Like a palace is going to be built for Sarah and her husband, who's a war hero.
And yeah, actually, that's a good point. This is all happening while the queen is ostensibly leading
a war,
Great Britain's war against France, in which Sarah's husband is fighting.
Yeah.
Abigail and Sarah both use that as sort of a proxy as well for their competition to win the queen's favor.
And once Abigail wins, Nat, how does it go?
Oh, it goes great. You know, she's super happy. She feels completely secure.
She's fulfilled. Yeah. She's fulfilled.
Yeah, she suddenly knows happiness for the first time in her life. No, Abigail still feels insecure. She becomes sort of a drunken party girl about court, but still feels like Sarah is a threat to her position. And so she frames Sarah's husband for embezzlement. And convinces the queen to exile her former friend, friend and her husband. The final scene is Abigail and the queen alone and sort of realizing that they both hate each other because the queen still treats Abigail like a servant, and Abigail sort of reveals this like cruelty and capriciousness that she's disguised throughout the film.
Right. And it has one of the more interesting, I mean, normally we don't discuss like actual end frames in the plot synopsis, but the end frame of this film is pretty fascinating. It's Abigail massaging the queen.
Her gouty leg
as the rabbits that the queen has just slowly fade into view. I saw this in theaters for the first time, and I remember just being like, just amazed that absolutely that was same. The end. Yeah.
Let's dive into that final frame as well and talk about its significance, because it's so good. The Favorite debuted at the 2018 Venice Film Festival, where it won the Grand Jury Prize and Best Actress Award for Olivia Colman, who plays the queen. And from there, it just swept award season, really.
Yeah, I did some research for this episode, and I just gave up trying to compile the number of awards that it was nominated for in, like, various countries.
Yeah, and Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone, all three leads, got so much praise and so many trophies for their performances.
And it's because they are just operating at a 10, I think.
I mean, you could say that The Favorite was the critics' favorite that year.
Yeah, I would say so.
You could say that.
You could say
you
that.
You could say that. So, Allie, you were saying in the plot synopsis, you saw this movie in theaters when it came out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I did too, because I remember just being overwhelmed by this world that the movie created.
Yeah, I found it just so thrilling, especially because I really like Yorgos Lanthimos, but I also, his films are really dark.
Yeah, very dark.
And I really have to like work up my kind of like ability to dive in. I always enjoy it when I do, but they're always just like, they're all dark comedies, but this one was a little more grounded or something. You know, a lot of them are kind of these like elevated fables.
Yeah. I'll make an embarrassing confession. This is the only Yorgos Lanthimos movie I've seen.
Not that's crazy.
I know. I'm sure I'll love The Lobster. I might even enjoy Killing of a Sacred Deer, but I have not seen anything else he has done.
Interesting. Well, this one in a way feels like, I don't know if this is the right word to use, but maybe like the most accessible.
Yeah, which is wild.
Which is given crazy.
It's a movie set in 1711. Like, who the fuck knows anything about 1711? Mm-hmm. It's not even like a normal period for a period movie. Like, it's not ancient Rome or the American Revolution. Like, there's no established assumptions about it, which really works to the film's favor.
Yeah, and some of the articles I was just reading about this time period is that, like, this is not even a favorite time period to pay attention to for historians.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of just like, here, let me see. Yeah. This is from Harper's. According to Elaine Challis, professor of British history and head of department at the University of Liverpool, both the time period and the monarch herself have not been regarded as interesting to study, with historians instead focusing their resources on other supposedly more interesting historical events which took place on either side of Anne's reign.
Aw, that's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, and part of that has to do with like a battle for an heir that kind of, like, she never produced an heir, and
right. There
was this whole, like, battle for who was going to take over after she died. So I think another article just said that even by the time she took over as queen, this whole heir debacle had already kind of been unfolding. And it's almost like a lame duck session as a monarchy.
Yeah, like
people
they
were just
more
like over
interested.
It, waiting for her to die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which really sucks.
Not good for the self-esteem of a queen.
No, I cannot imagine that it is. And also, I know there's a lot of historical fiction in this film, but one thing I know is true is that that Queen Anne was pregnant 17 times and lost every child.
Yes.
Which yes. I cannot imagine the mental toll that would take on a human being.
I think really, really incredibly portrayed Olivia Colman. Yeah, I was going to say Emma Colman. I just like put their names together. And yeah, I think her longest living child, according to the research I did, died at age 11.
Wow. That's
brutal. Yeah. Time.
Brutal, brutal, brutal. And doubly so for a monarch and a female monarch who, you know, It's very rare in this period for a woman to directly succeed to the throne in her own right. But even then, like, her main job was to produce someone to take over when she died.
Yeah. Do you want to know some more history?
Actually, yeah, I'd love that. It might be interesting. I don't know anything. I know very, very little about this period.
Well, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of talk about the things that are disputed. And actually the biggest thing that this film portrays that's really, really disputed is whether or not Queen Anne had any queer relationships. Mm. And what's interesting is the majority of historians really think she didn't.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this so before.
I don't know. To me, that's one of the things that's interesting about this film is that it kind of takes the rumors that were swirling around her reign and acts like, okay, what if this were true?
Accepts this as fact.
Yeah, what might have been like the interpersonal power struggles? Yeah. Which I have to say, this film as being like all about like who is the favorite, it reminds me that I think the best TV and films are always people vying to be someone's favorite. like Succession.
you don't mean Employee of the Month?
Oh my God, no.
That's a joke for our Patreon subscribers.
It's a deep cut. That's a deep cut.
No, I see what you mean, because it really is a way of creating a competition with like a referee, basically, where it's like, you know, we can determine who is quote unquote winning based on who Anne is happiest with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any more history giblets for us?
I have some more history. Yeah, please. I'll give you a little more history. So just to give a little more context to like, basically, Sarah and Anne did meet when they were very young. Mm. And it's well documented that Anne, you know, really liked Sarah, and that Sarah was, you know, really smart, and that she was like, whether or not she liked the Queen Anne, she was like, I should obviously be friends with this person who's about to be the queen. And it's also pretty well documented that Sarah could be really mean to the queen and could even like make her cry. And they have letters between the two of them that Sarah really did threaten to kind of
really
reveal to the public in a way that would besmirch her reputation. And the letters are very passionate and romantic. But the reason the historians think there wasn't any true queerness there is that like these were the types of female friendships that were really encouraged in that time period. I know. Don't shoot the messenger.
I'm not mad at you. It's just like, it's the classic, like, oh, they were such good friends, historical bias, where it's like, No, it was just really normal for men to suck each other's dicks in Shakespeare's day. Like, that's all. It was just normal. Yes. And it's like, yeah, so it was normal to be queer. No.
Here's one quote from Anne, a line from her letter, from a letter to Sarah. I had rather live in a cottage with you than reign empress of the world without you.
That's really beautiful, actually.
I know.
I would be very interested to see if, like, maybe this film inspired more scholarship on the like Queen Anne's reign, particularly through like a potentially queer lens. Like you said, like this is a very neglected period in history. And so I'm not surprised that there is like a simple historical consensus that seems so like sure, given how ambiguous it is. Like, I imagine not many historians even have an opinion on whether or not Queen Anne was queer in any way.
Right. Yeah. I would be really curious too. I'm not sure, but it's interesting. So let me read this quote.
Sorry, I honestly did so much research. It's like
overwhelming.
Yeah. But
you're too smart for your own good, Allie.
Oh, I know. Okay, so this is from a piece in Vanity Fair. Though the wording of the letter sounds romantic, romantic friendships were encouraged between young women at the time, and strong emotional language was not rare for these platonic friendships. Even so, Sarah went so far as to transcribe select excerpts in letters to Anne, threatening her that such things are in my power that, if known, might lose the crown. Da 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 da. But
doesn't sound like it was perfectly normal.
Well, here's the historical counterpoint to that. Yeah. So basically, during this time, Sarah was so upset at having been usurped by Abigail, she was kind of really encouraging the rumors that the relationship between Abigail and Queen Anne was, quote, unnatural. Mm. But historians say that the way that a queen was viewed and in this period in history as being basically one step to God, you know?
Yeah.
That it's possible that this commentary about the unnatural friendship was simply about the fact that Abigail was a lower class and was really outside of the circle that should be like...
The queen was supposed to move in.
Right, yeah. Like, it's one thing for her to be, you know...
Her lady's maid.
It's another thing for her to have kind of taken Sarah's place as the favorite.
And like the counselor. Yeah, that's interesting. And it is very common for sort of outlandish rumors to spread about absolute monarchs, because it's pretty much the only way you can try to undermine them. Like, you can't say, you know, that they don't have a right to rule, because that would question the entire system of personal monarchy. And so I know, like, in Rome and ancient Egypt, it was very common for sort of like extreme rumors to spread. Like, I think Caligula is often pointed to as like, he probably wasn't a literal Caligula. He was just like a weird guy. But because no one could say the emperor should be deposed, it was like, or that he shouldn't be emperor, they had to be like, well, no, he's just into like crazy sex things.
And you're totally right. And I came across that argument as well. This is actually a really funny line from an article in Vulture. Calling the monarch gay was a fairly common way to slander your political opponents in the early modern period, the way people today accuse their elected officials of being born in Kenya or doing 9/11.
I mean, yeah, that adds up.
But I will say there was one argument against their queer relationship that I thought was very lazy.
Yeah.
So I don't want to besmirch this biographer. Her name is Anne Somerset, and she's like considered like
Anne Somerset. Consider yourself on
not
notice.
At all. No, not at all. Not at all.
Watch your fucking back, Anne Somerset. Allie's coming for your reputation.
No, but a lot of the articles I
keep
read,
your head on a swivel, Professor Somerset.
No, a lot of articles I read referenced her, and also referenced her as like one, like the foremost living expert on Queen Anne. But here's a quote from Vanity Fair.
Not for
again.
Much longer.
Biographer Anne Somerset argued that such a relationship was unlikely given many factors, including the monarch's prolific sexual history with her husband. That is...
There
that,
fucking is.
And that's among many other reasons that are more valid, including the fact that, like, her health was very poor pretty early in her life, and there's kind of a question of whether she, like, had much of a libido because of her various health issues. And also there's the fact
well,
that
I would
like,
say, I mean, to that, I would say there are plenty of people with disabilities or with low libidos who are still like romantically interested in other people or sexually interested.
That's definitely true. Definitely true. Yeah. But then there's also the point of like the court being extremely busy, like way busier than is maybe portrayed in the film. And it would have been hard to have a relationship like this. But anyways, yeah, the issue I take is with the idea that because she had great sex, or not even great, yeah, we don't know. Because
just
she
any
had
sex
lots,
at all with her husband.
Right, because she had lots of sex with her husband, that precludes a relationship with Sarah or Abigail. Obviously, as a bisexual, I'm like, listen.
Listen. Listen.
We must hold both ideas in our head.
Yeah. And I especially find it interesting that there's sort of a paradox of like, well, she couldn't have been into women. She had so much sex with her husband. And besides, she probably didn't have a libido anyway. And it's like, well, hang on a second.
Right.
You just
Which
said
is it? Which is
that she
it?
Had tons of sex with her husband. means. Which
well,
is
I think
it?
I think that
and
it's
obviously
like,
yes, there's a social obligation to have children.
Yeah, in the historian's defense, I think the idea was that like particularly later in her life after her husband died, which is when
a lot of this.
But also her husband was alive for a good portion of this time, and he was just completely cut out of the film.
That's really funny. I love that. Actually, that's a really good segue into talking about like transitioning from the actual history to the world of the film, because I think this movie does a really good job of creating its own bubble world where it is sort of, you know, it's not necessarily meant to be like documentary because there's no way they talked like this, but the way they talk in the film evokes the way they would have spoken at the time. Like it feels to us the way it would have felt to them.
That's interesting. I feel like I don't know what it would have felt like to them at all.
Yeah.
But I do think that this film just does so many things to – it makes so many moves that create its own weird world. Like, and literally moves. Like so much actual physicality. Like the dance scene is notorious from this film.
I love the dance scene in this film. It's so fucking weird.
Will you describe it? I'm just curious.
Yeah, sure. So it's a ball scene early in the film. The queen is like hosting a ball at court. You know, we haven't even mentioned Nicholas Hoult as Robert Harley, the leader of the opposition. He like tries to get her attention about something going on in the war. We'll have to talk about him more later. But Sarah sort of interrupts and distracts the queen by going to dance with Colonel Masham, who's sort of a member of the retinue. And it starts off as like a very period appropriate line dance, essentially, the way you would picture in like a Regency film, everybody dancing in rows. But then it like evolves into this really weird like voguing swing dance, like choreographed hybrid of anachronistic moves where like Masham is picking Sarah up and spinning her around.
Yeah, and they're like doing these funny little hand motions in front of their face.
Yeah, he's like flopping in front of her and like it's really disorienting and it feels very like alienating to a modern viewer. It's really strange.
I almost wonder, like, I didn't come across in the research I did, and not to say it might not be out there, like a kind of explanation for that scene, but I almost wonder, it's at this point, we're a little accustomed to watching period films in a certain way, I think.
Totally, totally.
Like, and I think a little bit our eyes, you know, glaze over when there's a dance scene because we're like, right, yeah, dance, like
it's
they dance.
It's pretty dancing, whatever.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, just like you said, it kind of is just shocks you this moment and it kind of brings, and it feels extremely otherworldly in a way that like this should feel otherworldly because it's the 17th century, but it's weird because they use contemporary dance moves to then make this scene just feel completely like bizarre.
Bizarre is just the word for it. And that sort of pervades the whole film. Like that's the aesthetic principle of the film is sort of the grotesque, the strange, the disorienting. You know, I think one thing, the cinematography by Robbie Ryan was praised for its use of super wide angle lenses.
So cool.
So wide. And it really helps, again, shake up those assumptions because we associate this sort of wide angle lens with like contemporary security camera footage or documentaries found footage. You know, these very contemporary settings, but not films, not even contemporary films, really use these wide angle lenses that often because it really distorts near the corners of the frame. It's almost like, you know, how a map, you take a round globe and squish it onto a flat map. It's like that, where it's like you're squishing more information into the frame than it should fit by rights.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And it gives this sort of like this omniscient feeling to the audience where you feel like you see everything.
Yeah.
But that also happens in like the editing and the choreography and the set design, how everything is so monochrome, black and white, including, of course, everyone points to the floor that's like black and white checked like a chessboard. But also Abigail and Sarah's outfits in particularly tend to be black and white opposing and switch back and forth, sort of representing that neither of them is actually morally superior. It's like a dollhouse in a lot of ways. It feels very constructed, but also very lived in because, like, you kind of get the impression everyone smells bad, you know, things like that.
Yeah. And I think they do a lot to, I don't know, not emphasize, but I think there's a lot of moments where just like the grossness of that period, or not grossness, but things that feel gross to us because we're so insanely like
different,
steeped in like modern amenities and healthcare and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and egalitarianism, I mean, frankly.
And egalitarianism. Yeah. But just like early on when she gets shoved out of the carriage and she's covered in mud, and then she finds out that people like to shit there as a political statement, so she's also probably covered in shit.
Yeah.
And like she's washing the floor with lye
and burns her hands,
really burns her hand. Yeah. And she's so happy to have this room that like is just the most cold, dark,
sad
looking,
like prison cell.
yeah. And you know, this gout that the queen suffers from is just seems so painful, and
they're like wrapping it in raw beef to stave off infection, and it's like, I don't think that's gonna help.
yeah.
You know, there are three major characters here, and when I say major, I mean they're pretty much the only ones with like personalities, not personalities, yeah. But the only ones with like really rich inner lives, and they're all three of them queer in one way or another. I would love to like go person by person and sort of analyze each of them. How does that sound?
Sure.
To you?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Great. So how about we start with Queen Anne, since we've already talked about her a bit, and she is, even if I would say she's not the protagonist, but she is the sort of focal character that the entire plot hinges on.
Everything orbits around her, even if she's kind of not exerting a lot of power.
Yeah, which makes sense because, like, as the Sun King said, l'état c'est moi, I am the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that was certainly true of Anne at the time, where, you know, even in some scenes, she'll talk about ourselves, the royal we, referring to both herself and the country of England.
Mm-hmm.
In some of her later scenes where she's, when she's like regained some mental function.
Yeah.
How would you describe Anne, or this version of Anne?
The film's version of Anne is very fragile.
Yeah.
Very uncertain, quite needy.
Yeah.
Just very sensitive, like easily moved to tears.
Yeah.
She's someone who's been submissive in terms of Sarah. You know, she's really used to being pushed around by her. But she also, every once in a while, it seems like she suddenly flips the chessboard of their dynamic.
Right. She's sort of mercurial.
Yeah. She doesn't seem like a very fit person to rule a country.
I would agree with you there.
You know?
Yeah. And she seems sort of almost like childlike in some ways, where she just wants someone to play with her, really.
Yeah, she doesn't seem that informed about her country.
Certainly at the start of the film, it feels like she's very much like checked out and is more just obsessed with like making Sarah happy. Like, like Sarah is her world just as much as everyone revolves around Anne.
Yeah. She's a very tragic figure in the film.
I agree. I remember when this movie came out, my Nana saw it and didn't like it at all, which is not surprising in the slightest. my Nana is a librarian with, you know, generally conservative tastes. Not politically, just in film and literature.
Aesthetically.
Exactly. She's a cultural reactionary. But no, and she said, like, I feel like they ruined her reputation, you know, Queen Anne's reputation. They completely disrespected her. And I completely disagreed. I thought that, you know, this character is so fascinating to watch in every scene. It's like, even though, you know, this is a movie populated with incredibly witty and intelligent people who say sharp, like, lines constantly. Like, it's a very elevated dialogue style.
Yeah.
Except for Anne, who, you know, just sort of says what's on her mind. And yet she's the most watchable character on screen. You just want to see what she's going to do next.
Yeah. But it is sad. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Just because it feels like in that way where you're talking about where she's always just saying what she's feeling, like it seems like she's almost unaware that games are being played around her, you know, and because of her
sometimes. But then there's also the scene where Sarah sort of starts her campaign to win back Anne's affections, Anne is like giggling as they're like walking into her chambers, and Sarah says like, "You are enjoying this, aren't you?" Like she is clearly aware at the very least that Abigail and Sarah are competing for her attention.
Right. I agree, but I don't. It's hard to tell for me. Is she aware that underneath that competition for attention is for Abigail like kind of a competition for restoring her former place in the world, and for Sarah a competition for like power? I like, that's what I'm sometimes like, does she know?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like she sees those dimensions. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, she's kind of just like, it's all about me.
Yeah, it feels to me like she gains more awareness of the larger political context after she has exiled Sarah. Like she begins to realize how much Sarah had been in control,
right?
And now that she has a new favorite who Abigail has no interest in politics, suddenly Anne has to form her own opinions for the first time in who knows how long.
Yeah.
And she begins to think of herself more as a monarch, you know, to use that royal we more often.
Yep.
And to act more as a ruler rather than, you know, sort of this petulant invalid. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Olivia Colman's performance as well, because she won the Academy Award for Best Actress the year this came out, and it fully seemed deserved to me, because this character is so grotesque in a way that female characters in particular almost never are allowed to be, which is that she is sort of disgusting sometimes, but she is not mocked for it. You know, there are jokes at her expense, but she herself is not a joke. Mm-hmm. She is a fully dimensional character.
It's hard because I see what you're saying. I think she is a fully dimensional character, but I do think there are lots of characters in like literature and film that are just kind of like the woman who's the butt of the joke. Like, I guess I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying, but I don't totally agree. I mean, I just think it's an amazing performance, but I don't know if I see like the role itself as particularly like groundbreaking or singular.
That's fair. And I mean, I guess to me, it's sort of like I think we talked a little bit in Everything Everywhere All at Once, where I had seen the character of a middle-aged Asian American immigrant who runs a laundromat before, but I had never seen them as the lead, never seen them where you get to see their personal hopes and desires, things like that. And so to me, what's really fascinating about the role of Anne is that there is so much space given to what she is feeling, what she is going through, what she can't express. And so much of like her private sort of deprivation from normal human interaction is emphasized. And the ways that it has sort of misshapen her ability to form social ties, where she really can never be sure that anybody really cares about her or just wants proximity to the throne. It's absolutely true. Like a lot of that is due to Colman's performance. Like I think the scene I always think of is the ball scene as that weird dance is going, it cuts to Olivia Colman and it's this like really long take of her just watching the dance and going from pleased to sad to inconsolable without saying a word or without any clear indication of what is going on in her head. And so, yeah, it's absolutely like her performance elevates it.
Yeah, I agree. That scene is so good. It's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Just such a strong performance by Olivia Colman.
I love her so much.
Yeah. I guess my only thing about her role is that I still feel like the perspective of the film is between Abigail and Sarah and almost leans more towards Abigail.
Mm.
So I almost feel like there could have been more of the queen. There's something about the film that still feels like she's a bit of like a secondary character.
I see what you mean. Yeah. I think it's partly, again, that she isn't as expressive with her words as the other two leads are. And so and she is sort of like a football where it's like everybody's trying to control her and, you know, keep her, you know, under their influence and things like that. And less is given to her agency. Like it feels like ploys always work on her. She never like sees through anything. She just sort of reacts exactly as people intend, or maybe overreacts in the same direction.
Well, and I think part of the reason why I feel like it's less from her point of view is just like her position is static.
That's very true.
She's not really throughout the film. She's not like risking losing her position. Like the stakes for her in this film are like somewhat lower than for Sarah and Abigail.
I see what you mean. I wouldn't say they're lower so much as they are less tangible, you know? Like for her, the stakes are love and affection and genuine care, you know, whether or not she'll receive these things. You know, there's not really a threat to her status as monarch at any point. Whereas with Sarah and Abigail, like you were saying earlier, when they're competing to be the queen's favorite, it's pretty easy to tell who has the upper hand at any given moment.
Yeah.
I also think the film partly feels like it's from Abigail's perspective, because she is sort of the audience surrogate in some scenes, in that she is the one who comes to the court from the outside. And so we are introduced to the functions of court through her perspective.
I also think we're just...
Which feels like a pretty good segue to talk about her character.
Oh, let's talk about it. Well, I think we're just used to films where there's like a striver.
Yeah.
You know, I think... And she's such a striver.
Yeah.
And in a way that's such a, like, I don't even know that that kind of person would be familiar to, like, this time period.
Yeah. I think they would just be dismissed as a social climber.
Right. Exactly. Versus, like, now we're so used to the storyline of someone who's trying to better their circumstances, because that is the story that underpins capitalism's power, is that you can always just work hard enough and go to the right schools and meet the right people and improve your circumstances.
Yeah.
When this time period was much more just about what were you were born into and who you married.
I would say, like, again, I'm not super familiar, but I would say that there is still sort of a history of like the noble character fallen on hard times trying to regain their status. And so that would have probably been more familiar.
Which is exactly what she is.
And that would have been more familiar to like a contemporary audience. Like, if you, I think the one like literary reference that helps me ground this film is when Rachel's like threatening the queen with the letters and says, like, imagine if Jonathan Swift got his hands on them or something. And it's like, oh, got it.
Right.
But yeah, Abigail, it is interesting. Like, that is sort of the spine of her character, is wanting to regain her nobility. And what's fascinating to me is that at the beginning of the film, we're on her side a bit, where it's like, yeah, it fucking sucked to be poor in 1711. I don't blame you.
Yeah.
But by the time she achieves it, we realize that there's nothing else to her ambitions in the world. She doesn't care about anything bigger than herself. And so the film pulls a really interesting trick where we first empathize with her, then we are still like, get where she's coming from. And then by the end, we're like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, it's you kind of think at the end that maybe that fulfillment of her ambition will reveal a greater motive or another desire will take its place. But it's startlingly empty.
Yeah, it is sort of like an individualist nihilism, where it's like, it's all about her personal fulfillment. And then she fulfills herself and she has nothing left to live for.
Yeah. And the film does a good job of kind of like getting us on her side. I think we've discussed some other films that have this kind of upstairs, downstairs divide.
Totally.
And at least like in some period dramas, there's like downstairs camaraderie. And in this, there's just like,
oh,
she's basically hazed by the other kitchen servants.
Yeah. One in particular just seems to take an instant dislike to her and do everything in her power to make her life miserable.
Yeah. And it really makes you as an audience member feel like her striving is like a matter of survival, because
totally
by like being kind of a fallen noble lady, if she's going to work as a kitchen maid, or, and if she's not, she's going to be the butt of jokes and kind of be going to be picked on.
Yeah, there is no other alternative for her. It's not like she could settle into a happy life,
right?
You know, just being a maid and no more.
There's so many moments where she is so conniving. There's one moment with Harley where she breaks into tears because he's kind of trying to get information out of her. And right as he turns away, she makes a facial expression that's clear she's just been faking it.
Totally. That's the thing. And it's a ploy not for his sympathy, just to make him uncomfortable so that he'll go away.
Yeah.
And that sort of escalates throughout the film. Like, as it's almost like a prank war in some ways between Sarah and Abigail, But one of the things she does is, like, Sarah fires Abigail at one point because she caught her having sex with the queen. And Abigail takes a book and smashes it into her own face repeatedly, then goes crying to the queen, acting like Sarah did it. Which I've heard that called a wounded gazelle gambit before, but it is like a really conniving ploy to, you know, win sympathy that way.
Yeah. And all of her kind of behavior towards Masham, the man she eventually marries, is just also really well, very calculated, you know? Yeah.
And very sadistic. The few scenes where she does seem genuinely happy, one of them is when Masham is, like, trying to seduce slash assault her in the woods, and she just, like, beats the shit out of him, and he doesn't do anything about it because he's so horny for her. She, like, kicks him in the groin, slaps him in the face, punches him, and she's just laughing the whole time.
Well, and the first time they kiss, she bites him.
Yeah, she, like, comes to her room.
In her room.
Yeah, yeah. She, like, just rips into his lip.
And her character, her background is that she was basically sold to some German because her dad, like, as a gambling debt, and kind of had to endure rape from this man that she was gambled away to. So she just has this very, like, I think whereas Anne is kind of really enjoying this romantic, you know, love triangle, everything about Abigail's romantic dalliances in this film, whether with Masham or the queen, feel like calculated and about survival and about, like, securing her nobility, and don't really feel about genuine romance.
Absolutely. Or even pleasure.
Yeah. Or even pleasure.
That's the thing. Yeah. It is. I forgot how much discussion there is of sexual violence in this film. Like, I remembered, of course, this is the classic line when Masham shows up at Abigail's bedroom at night and she says, "Are you here to seduce me or rape me?" And he says, "I'm a gentleman." And she says, "So rape then," which is incredible writing.
Yeah. But, and it's funny, but so dark.
So dark.
Yeah.
So, so dark. And so much of the conversations about Abigail's history up to this point, or like the stakes for her if Sarah succeeds in exiling her, are framed in terms of sexual violence, and like the sexual violence she has suffered and will suffer if she isn't able to secure her position at court.
Yeah.
Which is really hard to watch, honestly. Like, I forgot about a lot of that.
Yeah. And I mean, even when Sarah ends up at a brothel, I think.
Yeah.
Like, after being poisoned.
Yeah. She's like found by a prostitute in the woods and taken back to a brothel.
Right. And then someone from, I think, the House of Lords. Yeah, someone up
Godolphin, the prime minister.
Yeah. He comes to get her. And he asks, "Oh, did they rape you?" And it's all so casual.
Yeah.
And it is startling, just as it's treated as this kind of fact of life.
And what's remarkable about that scene in particular is that she says, "No, they didn't." And she almost seems like surprised for a second, like, "Oh, yeah, I forgot they didn't do that."
Right. Yeah. Do you have more thoughts on Abigail? Anything else you want to?
You know, I find her really interesting because, like Anne and like Sarah, she's never one thing 100%. Like, even as she becomes less sympathetic, like once she is a lady, I would say is really the turning point when you stop sympathizing with her, because it's like you are secure. Now you have a title and a husband, but she still keeps going. So I would say that is the point where it turns, but she still has these really humanizing moments, like after Sarah is exiled, Sarah writes letters to the queen to try and win her back, basically. And we see Abigail reading one and crying and, like, genuinely being moved and then burning it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not explained how she feels in that moment. Like, we're really not given access to what's going on in her head. But it's clear that it's more complicated than, ha, you know, it's not demonic, psychopathic, single-minded focus on destroying her enemy. It's like she seems genuinely sad that she has to do this in her mind.
Well, you can kind of read her character. I mean, you can read her as kind of just being secretly conniving the whole time. But also, I think it's very legitimate to read her as being kind of this sweet girl, almost too sweet for what's happened to her, who kind of just by watching Sarah,
yeah,
realizes what she needs to do. This is really actually like laid out through these scenes that are interspersed where they are shooting birds together.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in the beginning, Abigail is a really, really poor shot. And by the end, she's getting really good. And I think it kind of mirrors the way that she's slowly getting better at kind of manipulating court intrigue and like,
yeah,
manipulating things for her own personal ends. So I almost wonder if that moment is just a moment where she's mourning like this person that she had to become.
Yeah.
You know, when she kind of came in as this like naive girl
who's just eager to please.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other through line in Abigail's character is that her main strategy, at least at first, is just to try to make other people happy so they won't hurt her. Like in her introductory scene, she's sort of like tricked into walking into a room where Sarah is covered in this muddy shit. And her immediate, you know, ploy is to, you know, apologize and try to make nice. And like, she's like, I want a job. And Sarah says, as a monster to frighten the children. And Abigail takes a beat. The most imperceptible beat, and then says, yes, if you'd like, you know, and makes a joke of it. And like, this shows she's willing to do it. And, you know, the way she wins favor with the queen is going into the woods and finding herbs to treat her gout, which I guarantee were more effective than whatever a doctor said to do at that time. And so it definitely does feel like there is a read where that's not necessarily all strategy. You know, some of it probably is genuinely wanting to make other people happy. But there is also things like even early on, she coughs very noticeably in front of the queen and says, I'm sorry, I think I caught a cold when I was collecting the herbs for your leg. So she wants credit even at the beginning.
Well, even when she brings the herbs in, she lies and manipulates to even get in permitted into the queen's chamber. So yeah, it's such an interesting character that she plays. This mix of sweetness and also, you know, conniving energy.
I
use the word conniving like
word. It's like scheming, you know, these are schemes, they're conniving, that's it, that it's court life.
Okay, but I've truly like never used the word conniving this much in my entire life.
I know it's just the only way to describe it. I want to circle back to something you said about Abigail's sexuality, because I think the way she interacts with sex is interesting given that she interacts with it the same way with both men and women. It seems like when she sleeps with the queen or when she jerks off Masham in that hilarious scene where it's like their wedding night and she is completely ignoring him until he like starts yelling at her, and then she just jerks him off to shut him up.
Yep.
Like it seems like for her, sex is a tool rather than a plaything of any kind. Like I don't think we really see any sense of sexual pleasure from her. Which is interesting in the context of like sort of the history of bisexuality in particular, where that sort of manipulation or manipulativeness or secrecy is sort of tied to queerness in general and bisexuality in particular. And yet it doesn't feel like biphobic in this instance. Like it feels like just a really interesting character moment because she is so well fleshed out. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I didn't see the way that her sexuality is portrayed as biphobic. I just saw it as like, this is a character who has been repeatedly sexually violated and kind of humiliated by her fall from society and has now been put in this position where she has to use anything at her disposal, you know, as she says later, once she gets married, to be safe.
Yeah.
And so it's literally just pragmatic for her. It seems like sex is just a means to an end.
It's sort of another tragic dimension of her character is that sex has lost any sort of human connective quality for her.
Yeah, definitely. It's sad, but there's like three bi characters in this movie, which is wild.
I know. And I think that also helps like sort of flesh out the filmmaker's perspective on queerness, you know, the authorial voice, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, obviously Yorgos Lanthimos, we've talked about his direction already, but the two writers, Deborah Davis and Tony McNamara, clearly also left their imprint on the sort of construction of the film and the voice of the film. I think, you know, comparing this to McNamara's series, The Great, starring Elle Fanning and Nicholas Hoult again, it's clear to see there's a lot of shared DNA there. And so the authorial voice as a collective creation.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's something we talk about a lot, is by having multiple queer characters, you're able to sort of negate any concerns over homophobia, queerphobia, biphobia, because so long as you're not doing the same exact thing with each of them, it's clear that their sexuality is not the determining factor.
Yeah, it also just, like, helps solve a problem of representation, which is that, like, representation is so important.
Yeah.
But sometimes when there's just one character who's standing in for an entire community, whether one of like orientation or race or religion, it can get really, you know, hairy, because that portrayal needs to be, that portrayal in order to be like dignified needs to also just be like a portrayal of an actual person and not just like
a model minority.
Right, right. And so when you have like multiple queer characters all in a film together, then there's more room for everyone to be just a human, you know?
Yeah. And it feels like a like concentrated version of something, you know, we've said before about like a scatterpoint graph, where it's like the more points on the graph, the more leeway you have. And so the more representation there is, the more leeway you have to portray characters who are more human and have more unsavory characteristics. And that's doubly true within the same like film, within the same story. The more queer characters you have in one story, you have like complete leeway at a certain point where it's like, no, I get it. It's just, this is how this character is.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Sarah?
Sarah is also a very tragic figure.
They're all so fucking tragic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's really
in such fun ways.
I know. It's like kind of, it's so funny because it's really like in a way his most whimsical film.
Yeah.
But also just ultimately so sad.
Yeah.
I mean, Sarah seems like someone who, I mean, as a character, she's kind of over this relationship she has with the queen in a lot of ways, but also completely locked in, buckled into the dynamic of it.
Yeah.
You know, can't escape it because of who the queen, the queen's the fucking queen, you know?
Yeah.
But I think she resents, she's very resentful, I think, and resents kind of having to entertain the queen while she's taken on these more important tasks of like really running the country.
Yeah.
And I also think she takes the queen for granted. She's so mean to her. And when Abigail begins to cut in on her spot in her life, I think she's really shocked.
Yeah. It is sort of that dynamic of like, you take your partner for granted, and then someone else comes along who like shows them attention, and you're like, whoa, hey, wait a second, what? I definitely see what you're saying about Sarah resenting the queen, but it does seem to me that a lot of her affection is also genuine. Like, there are a lot of moments where it actually hurts her position to do something for the queen. Like when she burns the letters at the end, that's her burning her leverage over the queen, and she loses because of it. She, not directly because of it, but she really has no recourse at that point. And so, you know, she is sort of making sacrifices for the queen, for Anne.
Right.
Even as she is like really cruel to her as well and bullies her a lot.
Well, in that way, it kind of is honestly pretty similar to the way a lot of marriages are portrayed in TV and film.
Yeah.
Where there is this affection, but there's also these years and years and years of patterns,
yeah,
that have built up and kind of locked people into these cycles and this behavior that is maybe not the most flattering.
Not great.
Not the most ideal. Yeah.
I mean, I think that you really nailed it. And I feel like that permeates the whole movie, is these patterns that trap people. You know, I think the key to Anne's character is how power has isolated her. And the key to Abigail's character is how the sort of misery of poverty has traumatized her. And with Sarah, it is how, you know, she's gotten into a routine, you know, and stopped appreciating her partner.
Yeah.
I find Sarah particularly interesting because of the three, she feels like the only one who believes in something bigger than human affairs. You know, the queen really seems focused on just having someone to love her. Abigail is very focused on her own station in life. But Sarah's motivations, the one consistent one, is her love of country. You know, she's always talking about patriotism, and not just as like a manipulative cudgel, though she uses it that way as well in many of her conversations with Harley. But it does feel like her main focus, even if she loves Anne genuinely or doesn't, her main focus is doing what she thinks is right for the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's most obvious in the fight, the war with France. But it's also, I think she has a line where it's like, Harley says, like, there are limits on love. And she says, love of country? I don't think so. I think there can be no limit on that. And it's clearly a rhetorical ploy, but, you know, I feel like it also reveals sort of the spine of her character, where it's like she believes in a particular form of England and is willing to do what it takes to protect it.
I might be wrong, but I even think that when she kind of threatens to blackmail Anne with their love letters, she again brings up love of country just because she's very uncomfortable. I think she's kind of shocked with the idea. She's like, no, 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 it's fine that I have been secretly running the country. But you can't have Abigail secretly the country just because she is your side piece, you know?
Yeah, there's a great line. Like, I don't mean to make her sound like some noble patriot, because patriotism, of course, is a tool of the bourgeoisie to divide the working class across national boundaries, when really the international solidarity of the worker is the only hope for our human survival. But, you know, there's a great scene where Anne says, like, I think the people hate the war. Let's go out and ask them. And Sarah, like, ridicules her. It's like, the people don't rule. They are ruled. You know, she very much is a monarchist, mm-hmm. even though she treats the monarch like her personal secretary sometimes, or as like a proxy for her own power.
Yeah. I mean, she's really beautifully portrayed by Rachel Weisz, just another like all-star performance.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's it. We didn't even name check Emma Stone on Abigail's section, but she is like, I generally like Emma Stone. I think she had a moment where she was a little overexposed and got, you know, obnoxious, but not her fault. It's just the way these things happen. But her performance in this movie is insane. Like, Emma Stone in particular, just capturing all the dimensions of that character. And Rachel Weisz, doubly so, just incredible, incredible performance as Sarah, where, you know, she's so awful in one moment and so tender in the next.
Yeah.
How would you describe her sexuality?
Oh, she seems firmly bisexual, I would
totally
say.
Totally, totally. But yeah. I mean, like, you know, we talk about how, like, for the Queen, it is sort of a professional obligation to have children, but also, like, her favorites both sort of service her in different ways. For Abigail, sex is a tool to get what she wants. How would you say Sarah relates to sex?
I mean, I would say her sex with Anne is a bit like, it feels like a mix, again, like a marriage. It almost feels like this kind of mix of obligation, but there's also genuine pleasure there. And I'm not saying that marriages should be that way. I'm just saying they're portrayed. I'm just saying they're portrayed that way in film sometimes. So it's like she's not purely using it as a tool.
Yeah.
But there's also a degree of, I don't know, like, I definitely get the sense that Anne wants it more.
It's interesting. I do feel like of these three, Sarah has the healthiest relationship with sex, which is partly a product of just not having been traumatized as much as the other two. Mm-hmm. She seems like to genuinely enjoy having sex with Anne at times. She seems to like have a genuine affection for her husband. It's not like he's just her beard.
No. Yeah, it's funny. They don't have that many interactions, but all their interactions are really infused with like such sweetness that you really feel like she loves her husband. And she also loves, in a really complicated, kind of tortured way, Queen Anne.
It's funny, like her husband is sort of her side piece.
yeah, definitely.
Well, and I think that gets to something that's really I love about this movie, which is that Harley is the one man who isn't sort of a prop, mm-hmm. you know? Most of the men, this is sort of a world where women rule, even if it is sort of through, you know, court manipulations, the men really are playing the women's game more than anything.
Well, and they're often just literally playing actual games where they're like,
yeah, totally. They're just dicking around throwing oranges at each other.
Yes. Yeah. So what did you want to say about Harley?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I fucking love Harley. Nicholas Hoult's performance as Harley is
very
insane.
Good. Very
He's
good. Yeah.
Just, I always think of the line where it's like the second time he approaches Abigail. She like is resisting giving him information. And he says, do you want to get punched? Mm-hmm. just so bluntly. He gets all the best lines. Like, I feel like you can't talk about Harley without talking about the dialogue style, where I think he says, like, you know, my friend Masham is quite construct with you.
Such a good line. Such a good line.
Oh, my God. It's so good. And also, I find it interesting that he, more than any of the other men in this movie, it plays up how camp he is, like the wigs. And he's always, he says, like, a man has to be pretty. Mm-hmm. Like, he is the most solidly queer coded of the men in this movie. And he's the one who seems to have his own agenda for once. Like, mm-hmm. Godolphin is Sarah's sort of like proxy, other proxy in public.
Yeah.
And then Masham is just a dumb, mean-spirited sex fiend. And even Lord Marlborough, you know, Sarah's husband, is like a nice guy, but he doesn't seem to have much interest other than winning wars for jolly old England. Yeah. But Harley is the one who actually like wants something. So it's interesting that it is sort of like this perspective on a period in history, whether real or imagined, when women and queer men were in sort of vying for control.
Yeah.
What do you think of him?
Well, at least that's the take of the film, but
that's the take of the film. Yeah, again, real or imagined. Yes. Real or imagined.
Yeah. I find him interesting because he's kind of this constant dose of realism, or not realism, but just like political urgency.
Real,
like,
politics.
Yeah, yeah, like, hey, we really can't spend this much money on this war because there will be riots, you know? Like,
yeah.
And it just seems funny because he's this character who's always just trying to get actual things done while these personal power struggles are going on.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I read that earlier versions of the script were much more historical and much more about how these interpersonal relationships affected the larger world, but that stuff kind of got stripped out as it really just became a more psychological drama about these three people. But I feel like his character is like the remnants of that, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. And also he's sort of another playmate for Sarah to work off of. Like,
yes.
Abigail attacks Sarah's personal life, but he attacks her politics.
Yep.
Before Abigail becomes Sarah's enemy, he is the one creating conflicts,
mm-hmm.
and in some ways initiates Abigail's enmity towards Sarah.
Definitely.
Because he wants to use her as a spy, and Abigail like tells Sarah about it and then is shocked to find that Sarah doesn't trust her, you know, as she just assumes that Sarah, you know, that Abigail probably told her just to win her trust. And it's like, well, no, I genuinely don't want to help him.
Yeah.
How do you feel about like the gender play of the film in general, like that sort of role reversal? What do you think of it? I don't know.
To be honest, I'm just so unfamiliar with the conventions of the time. Like, it's hard for me to even read anything into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm at a loss.
That's fair. I guess I was thinking more in terms of, like, the larger sort of period drama genre, regardless of the actual historical period, I feel like tends to, I think we talked about this in our Portrait of a Lady on Fire episode, there's this tendency to wink at the period and say like, oh, look, you know, how much better things are today, especially for women. I think that comes up, like the idea of like limits on women in historical periods, which is fine. Like in some cases, that's a really interesting vein to explore. But like you were saying about period pieces earlier, sometimes you kind of accept it into the background radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is like the dance scene, it is interesting to see a film violate that norm.
The norm of like men being more prominent, or just the norm of like
The norm of like really emphasizing patriarchy in period pieces as a contrast to the present day, you know?
I guess what's hard is just like, I still feel a lot of patriarchy.
Totally.
Acting in the background of the film, like particularly in Abigail's case where she really just like
totally
has to marry to get out of her circumstance. I mean, I love the fact that it's three strong three girl bosses. Three girl bosses.
Yeah, real role models.
Well, yeah, just like girl bosses battling it out. But I don't know that it's like playing with gender roles that much more than like I it's hard for me to read it in that way, you know?
I see what you mean. I definitely agree with you, like patriarchy and patriarchal structures still very much are the setting for the film. What interests me is the way that the characters use that sometimes to their advantage, but overall not. I guess it to me, it makes a more interesting commentary on gender roles that way, because it's not just like, you know, men enforce patriarchy, patriarchy bad. Instead, it's sort of like, here are three women in control of an entire country and they're still dealing with this bullshit.
Right.
But not that, but the characters themselves don't name it as bullshit in the way that I think some period pieces do.
Right.
Sort of put contemporary critiques into the mouths of historical women.
Yeah, no, that's just definitely not present in this film at all.
Yeah.
Which is nice, I think, personally.
Yeah. Any conversation about this film, I think, revolves around historicity. I meant to compare it earlier to Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, which was famous for its use of contemporary pop music on the score. Mm-hmm. Again, just that sort of idea of like different approaches to anachronism in historical films. Not just like giving characters smartphones or watches or cars, but like mixing, you know, diegesis and expression and filming technique to make it feel contemporary without actually changing things. It's just interesting. It does sort of what a period piece often is trying to do, which is show the past as populated by people as complex as we are today.
Yeah. Oh, beautifully said.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you have any other points you wanted to touch on while we were talking about this movie?
It's just a great film. Everyone should see it.
Yeah.
Everyone should see it.
As dark as it is so, so funny. It's one of those rare like strata of movie that will make you laugh even when you watch it at home alone, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. not just breathe out of your nose really loudly.
Yeah. And it's just like three powerhouse actresses.
Oh, just incredible work. Just incredible acting work and incredible writing. Just the rhythm of it is so gorgeous. That's the thing. It really feels like everybody was firing on all cylinders for this mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. Oh, we were going to talk about that final frame.
Mm, yeah.
This final scene of like Abigail sitting in the queen's bedroom while the queen's in bed, just completely like half dead. And Abigail like steps on one of her rabbits in one of the most uncomfortable shots I have ever seen. And like sees it and sort of has this realization of who this person is and like orders her to come over and massage her leg and grabs her hair to lean on her. And then, yeah, there's that image you talked about of like it first cuts from Anne's face to Abigail's, but then fades back to Anne's face and fades in like layers and layers of the rabbits hopping and sniffling and things until it forms this sort of mushy collage of Anne, Abigail, and the rabbits. And I'm just curious, what do you think of that image?
Very disturbing image.
Yeah.
To me, all these rabbits represent all these different futures that the queen could have had any of her 17 children survived. And all these kind of foiled futures that are just haunt her. And then for Abigail, this future that like she fought so hard for, that's really quite a miserable daily existence, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. I've never thought of the rabbits as sort of like a future thing. You know, I love that reading. For me, I've always read it as like, it's almost reminiscent of a scene in The Night of the Hunter, a movie that I just watched and is now one of my favorites. But there's a scene where a character sees a owl kill a rabbit and she comments, it's a hard world for little things. And I feel like in that scene, the fact that it's sort of equating Abigail and Anne and the rabbits and the abuse, you know, the fact that Abigail just stepped on one of these rabbits.
Yeah.
It's sort of this thing of like, just I don't know quite how to articulate it, but it feels like it's evoking this cycle of abuse and their continued vulnerability and how they are still like sort of at the whims of these larger forces that seem bent on their destruction. And, you know, they're both so sad and in cages and, you know, it's just sort of this oppressive, claustrophobic feeling that it evokes in me.
Yeah.
But I think it's both and neither and other things and everything all at once.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really cool shot to end on, just in
how very strange. Poetic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yorgos killed it. Can't wait for the next one.
Yeah. Yeah. Mic drop Yorgos. I think his next one, he's actually working with McNamara again.
That sounds great. I'm ready.
Shall we marry, fuck, kill?
Sure. Yeah.
Now, I have a question. Do you want to marry, fuck, kill our three wonderful leads, or do you want to turn men into our playthings and do marry, fuck, kill Harley, Masham, and Godolphin?
Let's do Harley, Masham, and Godolphin.
Yeah. Do you want to do Godolphin or Marlborough?
I think Godolphin. I think he's more
Marlborough
present.
Is an easy marry. He seems nice.
Yeah.
He seems like the one nice person in this movie.
Yeah.
Probably because he doesn't talk too much. What did Twain say? It's better to keep your mouth shut and appear stupid than to open it and remove all doubt.
I think so.
Yeah, substitute stupid with an asshole, and it applies to this movie. But yeah, sounds good to me. So Harley, Masham, and Godolphin. Damn.
For me, it's gonna be Mary Harley, because he actually seems smart and involved. Fuck. Masham, because he seems like a himbo, total himbo energy.
Yeah, except for the nice part. He doesn't seem very nice.
Yeah, it's true. And
he's as close as a himbo could exist in this world.
Right. And kill Godolphin, because he annoys me personally.
Fair enough.
Because he's such a... Isn't he the one that's
with his
like...
his fucking duck?
Yeah, well, and isn't he fighting so hard for the war?
He's just sort of following Sarah's lead.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
But he is the pro-war team.
Yeah, can't fuck with that.
That's interesting. I'm going to fuck Harley because I feel like you'd be better off being his mistress than his spouse.
Sure.
Me being the mistress in this case. I would kill Masham because he... aggravates me. He's just mean and horny.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would marry Godolphin because I could totally see living in the same house and never seeing him. Like one of the marriages common at this time, just complete marriage of convenience. I wouldn't have to deal with his bullshit. You know, he could just race his ducks and I would not give a shit.
Nice.
Beautiful. Well, I'll tell you who my favorite is, and it's the girl listening to this podcast, or guy, or gender nonconforming person, or whatever. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Snails and Oysters, your bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bisexual movie podcast. If you like the show, please review it, share it on social media, interact with us in as many ways as you can imagine. Ooh, yeah, interact with me, daddy. Whoa, sorry.
That's okay.
And if you really, really like the show, you can head over to patreon.com/snailsoysters to throw us a bone. And by a bone, I mean $5 a month. Mm-hmm. And in return for that bone, you will get... monthly bonus episodes and my film diary, basically. I write little blurbs about every movie I watch.
And the credits would not be complete without a shout out to the composer of our theme music, Billy Libby. Yeah, and the artist behind our
Abby
podcast.
Austin.
Yeah, Abby Austin. And you can find both of their social media handles in like the podcast description.
Our social media handles are there too. And of course, Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. Give us a shout out if you disagree with our Mary Fuck Kill takes, if you have a suggestion for future episodes, or if you think we completely misread our main trio and you think actually Abigail is a proletarian hero. We would love to hear from you either which way.
We want to hear it all.
Until next time, I'm Matt Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And thank you. For being
a bi-ally.